The following presentation, Boilerplate Code, Building Management Systems, was given by Aaron Leverett of IOActive at NetWorkshop 42 in April 2014.
Everyone's awake, I'm hoping. This is Building Management Systems. There's a wide variety of them. We'll talk about security issues, things that you can do to improve your deployment of these systems. They tend to be built cheaply and quickly, hence the title of the presentation. So a little bit of housekeeping, and we already covered some of this stuff, but if your phone goes off, I'll answer it. I spent a few years in the circus when I was doing other work in the evenings, and I hate it when the phone goes off and the other speakers are speaking. So. Feel free to ask questions during the presentation. I don't mind being interrupted as I go along. Sometimes it's easier. If you want to have a rant, however, find me later and we'll have a glass of wine and we can talk about things. And if the fire alarm goes off, it would probably be me. But not necessary. So some people think I do this. I don't know if any of you remember the film Hackers, but obviously I do. And when you spend time with other security professionals, you often ask them, what was the thing that got you into security? What got you interested in security? And for me, this scene was kind of critical. I'm not as interested in working for banks or protecting customer data or private information. I value that sort of career path, if you like. But the thing that gets my blood pumping and makes me want to go to work every day is working on physical systems that have a physical effect. And that's why I like this scene. I also like it because, you know, the hacker in the scene is not typing furiously at the keyboard. He's done all his work in advance, and now he's just putting up his umbrella and enjoying the effect. Unfortunately, this is not what my job is like, because it would be very expensive to turn off or on the alarms and the sprinkler system in the building. So really, my job is a bit more like this. We like to say SCADA security. I also do SCADA and smart grid and smart meters. And building management, it's like all good satire. It's kind of a cross between humor and horror. And that's very much how my days are spent. You'll see a little bit of that today. Unfortunately, I have not enough time to go through all of the details, but enough to give you a taste of it. So remember this slide, we'll come back. So today, if you deploy building management, do you know that you have a building management system in your network? Yes? Okay, good. A lot of people were unaware they even existed up to a few years ago in the information security community. So I'm glad that you know you have one. For those of you who've never seen one or never worked with one, it's quite common for them to have a thin client through the browser, not unlike this one. This is from a demo system that you can find online if you want to have a look and play with yourself. And it contains things like access control for doors and security, right? Lighting, fire, HVAC, which is heating, venting, and air conditioning. CCTV, energy management, these kinds of things. Sometimes they contain safety logic for lifts or elevators, escalators, things like this. But usually this is what you're dealing with. The good news is the web interface is not always directly connected to every device in the same way. And we'll get into that. But this is what they contain. And typically, a university will have them in a number of different buildings and may even have different products in different buildings. So what kind of information do they contain, let alone the physical effects? They often contain floor plans and layouts to your building. The access control can leak credentials or details for individual people in your organization and what rooms they have access to. The energy usage of your building, which many people don't have any privacy concerns about at the moment, but as things go on in the future, you may. There's a famous case in the US where the FBI showed up to and said, you're using an awful lot of electricity. You see that you're the highest user of electricity on this spur. Are you guys growing marijuana? And they had to take them for a tour around the facility and say, actually, no, we're doing protein folding. And it's very computationally expensive, and we've got these clusters, and we're using a lot of energy for this reason. So just keep that in mind in terms of energy usage and privacy. It can be a real concern. And obviously, that's a lightweight example, but it gets the idea across. So we do know that Anonymous and others have said they're not very interested in large critical infrastructure facilities that can kind of damage their cause, if you like. But there are a number of activists who are interested, right? Individuals. There's plenty of them on Twitter. You can follow them and see what they're getting up to. They typically publish the details, the IP addresses of vulnerable building management systems. Okay, so they get attacked because people want revenge. I do another talk on 10 industrial system incidents that occurred before Stuxnet, and the themes are very much, they get attacked for revenge by an insider, they get attacked by an outsider who doesn't really know what they've got, they get attacked by an outsider who was specifically targeting this facility for some reason, and then a very common story is they get hit by a virus or a worm 2 or 3 years later after the worm was released, because they still have the same kind of flaw. So the motivations for attacking these systems are very different than you would find. It's not, you know, stealing credit card numbers. Sometimes the goal is to create physical damage. The good news is most of these attackers may be reasonably skilled computer scientists or programmers, but they're not often engineers. So they don't usually know how to maximize the damage of the physical components of the building or the energy facility or whatever. That might change in the future. So. I guess the other good news is people don't really know how to monetize these attacks at the moment. So the most likely case that you might encounter is extortion. And we have seen a few of those cases. Okay, so building management systems, they're not just this web browser, right? They're very much a network of cheap devices. They need to be made very inexpensively. And they run a variety of different protocols. And we'll go over two of the protocols later on in the presentation. But one of the things I wanted to point out to you is that access control devices for doors or other, you know, entries into the building often contain the credentials in a small device. Now, by default, that's physically accessible on the outside of the building. It needs to be so I can swipe my badge and get into the building, right? Now, we don't see that many physical attacks on these devices, but if you can get into them, they have the usual embedded security problems, and sometimes you can pull the database of credentials from that device or even load your own. Loading those credentials is typically done by a bash script in a system like this, not always, but usually runs at some time of night or once a week or whatever, and that's why when you say, oh, I've got my new badge, can't you allow me access to, you know, the computer lab, they'll say, oh, you'll be able to have access in 24 hours or something. A lot of times they could actually, the systems could physically update you sooner, it's just the way they're written, right? So I wanted to show you this. This contains a Tritium JACE, which runs the Niagara web server, which had a number of vulnerabilities. They were included in my dissertation. More vulnerabilities were found afterwards. They typically have access to metering data and so on. And of course, you know, if you have access to the control panel or the door entry system network, you can sometimes convince a door to open for someone at a certain time. That turns out to be enormously useful in social engineering penetration tests. So I just want to point out here, because we're dealing with physical effects, this could be a precursor to a bigger attack, right? We've also, in penetration tests, used the CCTV component of these systems to watch people type in their passwords. Okay, so what kind of security issues do we see with these devices? I would say with the web application, you see all the usual stuff. You see authentication flaws of all kinds, including HTTP clear text credentials on some occasions. You know, sometimes you see HTTP basic, you know, auth and therefore base 64 and so on. You see directory traversal. In fact, that's how the Niagara systems were compromised by my friends Billy Rios and Terry McCorkle. So they found directory traversal, which gave them access to the credentials for the system. And then we're able to crack the hashes that are used. Cross-site scripting, of course, and external entity injection, which essentially works in largely the same way as directory traversal, and SQL injection. So you see all the usual flaws, right? And it's quite clear to me that these systems have not been tested as widely as the vendors would have to believe. As if that's not enough, people sometimes put them on the internet. I've done my best to encourage people not to do that for a little while, at least until they become more secure. And if some of you work in the cert teams in the universities, you may or may not have had an email from Janet or from me saying, by the way, here's this building management system with access to a sprinkler in a library that I know contains 16th century manuscripts because I'm a bit of a bibliophile. So please, can you take that off the internet? So we also see vendor maintenance accounts, which are hard-coded credentials in either the physical devices or in the web application that are undocumented. So if you read the manuals, those will be like your usual admin user, and then there'll be something else, a lower-level privileged user, and then it won't say anything else about any other accounts. But then when we go and reverse the firmware, you sometimes see another account, which might have, you know, the vendor name and some complicated string of letters and characters, and lo and behold, you discover that it's a backdoor account that none of you could even ever have known existed. And of course, once we find that, it's usually in all the devices of all of the systems, and it's possible for us to use that. My colleague Ruben Santamarta does great work finding these kinds of backdoors in systems all the time. We also find that they have incomplete network stacks on occasion, not so much the web application, but the devices themselves. And that can mean that when you scan them, they crash, which can be very, very frustrating. Now that's getting better, and we're doing our best to make sure it continues to get better, because I think one of the worst things you can do is not scan these devices and not know that you have them present in your network. There is one case of doing an Nmap scan on a building management system, and immediately after I performed the scan, someone burst into the room and shouted at me and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I just scanned the network." And they said, "Well, every building, you know, every door in the building has unlocked." So that was quite a while ago. Things are getting better, but yes. And also, I'd like to point out that some components to these systems are physically accessible, right? So your meters are often in a place where people can get to them. Your door access controller in a place where people can get to them. Sometimes fire alarms on the outside of the building are in a place where people can get to them. So that adds to the complexity, because we can sometimes perform physical attacks on a component, which gives us, you know, access to the network, which means we can sniff the credentials, which means we can roll up to the web app and find some way of compromising that. So keep that in mind as well when you're trying to defend the systems. Okay, so to try and help you out a little bit, I'm going to introduce you to two protocols. This is necessarily brief. I'll do what I can. LawnWorks is one common. The other is BACnet, and we'll be going through that. These have a neuron ID. So I'm going to talk a little bit about addressing, because I think it would help you. I know most of you are network people and you can keep up with this. So I know every lady's not going to go home and use this right away, but hopefully it gives you an idea of what you're seeing. So they have a neuron ID on the actual chip. That's basically like your MAC address, a five-layer address. And then on top of that, you bootstrap the neuron ID up to two logical addresses. Those logical addresses are made up of a domain ID, a subnet ID, a node ID. Oh, I'm sorry, I thought I put all the bytes in there. But I think it's 48 for the node ID, and the subnet, I can't remember, it might be 48 as well. But the domain ID is optional. The idea behind the domain ID is that if your meter is connected to a utility, it can have one domain address for the utility and a different one for you to keep the packets from routing up to the utility. It is possible to do sender authentication in this protocol scheme, but I have never seen it in deployment. It's optional, right? It's also often not done when I talk to people about why it wasn't deployed, because challenge response increases the packet length times two. Right? Sorry, not the packet length, the traffic, the network traffic. Okay, so here's some more of the jargon to give you another idea of the horror of these protocols, as if that wasn't bad enough, right? It's just no off. There are network variables called snippets in the common parlance, and these are basically over 100 different types. So think about your programming language theory. You've got 100 types, some of which are analog, some of which are digital, binary. You have ASCII, you have switch state, you have some safety logic, voltage, humidity, you get the idea. All these decimal point values flowing back and forth across the network alongside ASN1 strings and binary data and so on and so forth. The messages may be act or unact, so there is actually like a send and pray mode for these packets, which I find slightly disturbing as well. Right? As if it's not bad enough, we don't have enough auth, you can just send 3,000 packets on a network and see what happens, assuming you have a test network to play with. So that's a very, very rapid introduction to this protocol, but I hope that it gives you an idea of why I'm concerned and why I'm here today. So BACnet is another common protocol, building automation control. It can traverse an IP network. It can use either IP tunneling, or BACnet has its own IP version. My favorite feature of this was recently described by a friend, which is that foreign devices can join the backbone. So a device that is not currently present on the network can join. And that allows the reception of forwarded broadcast messages. So in a sense, you don't even particularly need to scan these networks if you're willing to sit and passively listen. But I really, really love this quote from the BACnet tutorial, which is basically from the standard. Wouldn't it be great if you could access a particular BACnet network over the phone from anywhere? That is the purpose behind foreign device registration, which can be carried out through any internet connection, static or dynamic. Also, no authentication for this protocol. I mean, you may have some, you know, in other places in the application, but the protocol itself at the network layer. So, you know, if that's not scary enough, once again, we have binary and analog data flowing in the same packets and being parsed by the same application. You know, if you're interested in LangSec, you know, this is kind of a nightmare. It's very complicated, right? So these are some of the different object types that you would see flowing back and forth across the protocol. Easy, right? No, I couldn't. it's a terrible mess, right? Luckily, the same person I was just talking about, Stephen Hill, is over at Digital Bond, and he's written, just in the last few weeks, a BACnet and a C script, and map script. So I thought I'd share that with you. It certainly keeps you from making some of the mistakes I have in the past, where you just unlock all the doors by accident. The good news as well is that some of the old BACnet will return an error and won't give you information about the devices, so the older devices won't tell you what they are. The newer ones will, but if they give you this error, it still means that it's a BACnet device and you can go and look it up and try and understand more about it. So I hope this gives you some impetus to get out there and look at your own network and think about how these things are going. How am I doing for time?
All right. Oh, sorry. Okay.
So, very briefly, the Homer problem. If you want to start looking at this, you're going to run into this. You're going to go and see your facilities management people, and their opinions are documented up there. You can all read, so I won't read them to you. These are the kind of reactions that you're going to get from facilities management. So my advice to you is to do something I think of as like a silent audit or a lunchtime audit, where you get to know the people, and you sit down, you have lunch with them, and you talk to them, and you show some interest in their system. Oh, you've got a new building control system. How does that work? Is that useful? Does it make your job better? And you spend some time getting to know them so that they're a little bit more friendly. And then you can start asking some questions about whether it's been security reviewed and how things are going, and explain to them some of the concerns and the problems. If you're lucky, you'll get someone who's interested in that. Mostly, you'll probably get some resistance. And that's why it's nice to make friends before you even approach the idea of having an exam. On the good side, you know, these are usually engineers, numerous people, people who sometimes are former law enforcement or military, so they have a good sense of physical security. And when you show that the access to these devices or these systems can compromise the physical security, they usually wake up and care and support your approach, right? But it's a real problem. So 3 minutes is a bit quick to go through this. I was hoping to go through some of the technical detail, but loosely speaking, these are some of the kinds of switches that you might find in this environment, not always. And I found 3 vulnerabilities in these. One's not considered a vulnerability because it's MD5 plus nonce brute force. Siemens doesn't consider that a vulnerability because brute forcing is brute forcing. It's the session IDs were completely predictable. They were actually hex. The last 8 digits of hex were the uptime of the device. So completely sequential and entirely predictable because SNMP could get me the uptime of the device. As if that was not bad enough, the front 8 digits of hex were the client side IP address encoded in hex. So completely predictable. Then I found a cross-site request forgery vulnerability in the firmware upload. So I was able to download the firmware, upload the firmware, download the logs, change the configuration, and this meant that you could take a previously known configuration with a previously known password, upload it to the device, change whatever settings you wanted, and then upload the old configuration which you previously downloaded, leaving thus no trace that you had changed the configuration of the device. Good news is that those have patches. The bad news is, well, when's the last time anyone patched a switch? Hey, all right. Okay, so you remember this face that I made earlier, right? As if it's not bad enough that the web application is probably filled with various flaws and protocols don't provide us much hope. On top of that, we have vulnerabilities in some of the network devices. So keep in mind that if someone does compromise one of the switches, they've got access to those protocols and they can just man in the middle of everything. So this is why I often wake up in the morning like this. Okay, good news is mitigations. There's a bunch of simple ones you can follow. Ideally, you want this on a separate LAN. I know you don't always have a budget, you can't do that, I understand, but at least put it on a VLAN, at the very least. If you can't justify that to your management, just take a few lessons in these protocols and show them how insecure the protocols themselves are. Disable external access, please, please, please. In the long run, if you want to put them on the internet, I'm kind of okay with that. But right now, they're still incredibly insecure, and I'd really rather you didn't for 5 years until we can bang on them a bit more and get the vendors to fix some of the basic software engineering flaws. And I'd like you to get out there and test the web interfaces. It's nice if you can hire a penetration tester, but if you can't, just get a student to do it. Look at it. You know, some of these vulnerabilities are relatively simple web application vulnerabilities, and we tend to think they don't apply because it's a building management system, but in the interface for the average everyday user, they do. So be careful, not because it's hard testing these, but just that they can be a bit fragile. You can crash a device here and there. So, in summary, facilities management couldn't possibly have imagined how prone they are. So be gentle with them and try and take some time to help them understand the problem. Protocols offer little to no protection, so don't hope that that network layer is going to protect you in any way whatsoever. Please, at the very least, segregate the network. And it's worth doing some penetration testing mainly to push vendor improvements. So there's two tricks there that I'd like to really offer you to take home with you. I hate giving a presentation that has no value to you. So the two tricks I'd like to offer are, if you don't have the budget to test a building management system, talk to the other people in this room and see who's running the same software as you are and pitch together. Build a little test network and you can all test the same system at the same time, right? And then that report can go back to the people in the network. So, okay, it's not a deployment test, but at least you're hammering on this interface and getting the vendors to improve. And sometimes they can take 6 months to a year to patch these devices. The other trick that you can play is, of course, it's not a trick, it's genuine. You can set off the sprinklers in some of these buildings, and water damage is pretty expensive to an entire facility at the same time. It's very easy to set off the fire alarm and have the fire service come out, and that costs money when they come for a false alarm. You can put these into your budgetary requests to have these systems tested, and I encourage you to do so. So that's not hyperbole. I hope I haven't given you a lot of FUD. Like I say, a lot of the attackers out there can't cause real damage because they're not engineers, but they can compromise these devices, and they are doing so and listening to some of the traffic. The good news is we haven't seen any particularly big malware focused on building management systems, but it's probably only a matter of time. Thank you for your time today. I appreciate you getting up at 9:15 and coming to listen to some crazy person talk about building management systems. But if you have any questions, then feel free.
Time for level two. You're around the conference?
I am. Yep, so I'll be here today and a little bit of tomorrow morning.
Are the vendors being forthcoming with patching the vulnerabilities that found in stuff like Niagara?
It's about 50-50. So I know Billy and Terry took ages getting some work from Niagara, but then we basically discovered that the company had been bought by Honeywell, and they went to Honeywell, and Honeywell put pressure on the company to get them fixed. Another thing that helps is ICS Cert, or certs in general. So ICS Cert, about a year ago, created a policy saying that if a vendor doesn't reply or doesn't promise a patch within 6 months, they'll publish. And that basically put pressure on the vendors to start bringing these patches in. It can take sometimes up to 2 years. I'd say on average these days it's taking 6 months to 8 months to get patches for these things.
Have there been any initiatives on the part of Janet to work with national facilities management organizations to sort of jointly lobby on these issues?
Not that I know. Okay. Yeah. But that's a good idea, right? Yeah.
And I think Janet held some kind of a forum with building management on the subject of relations with building management. The conclusion was relations as a whole on not the best.
We see exactly the same thing in the SCADA ICS environment. It's kind of internet technologies team, IT team versus OT team, operational technologies team. So it's engineers versus companies. And it's very, very frustrating, and I try whenever I can to bridge that gap and help out. But it's important to do that, I'd say, almost before you do the other stuff.
So does everyone think that?
Thank you. Thank you, Robert.
This recording was brought to you by Janet Training as part of NetWorkshop Online. Further information is available on our website at www.ja.net/training.